passenger on board the Meridian from St. Louis informs us that just as he left that place, intelligence had arrived there of the murder of ex-Governor Boggs at Independence, Missouri. The ex-governor was pierced through the back by 6 buckshot fired by an unseen hand. A reward was immediately offered for the apprehension of the assassin, and there was great excitement at Independence. The Courier-Journal, Louisville, Kentucky, May 16, 1842.
Remember how we tell you this isn't your grandpa's history? Unless your grandpa uses more F-words than we do, which so far our count is 0?
I think we're still at 0.
At least off.
That will change tonight. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, this isn't your grandpa's history. That's true. It's also not your grandpa's source of information. As a society, the technological revolution has slowly, gradually, and inexorably changed the world. We barely even acknowledge how wild it is. The speed at which information travels has changed so dramatically in the last 150 years. When Mormons were living in Nauvoo, info trudged along like a Curalum, maybe even a Cumum. Today? Faster than an angel with a flaming sword.
Two recent examples should prove it. Remember when all that we cared about was the Mark Hoffman documentary on Netflix? And when we saw Blessing Guy in all his Napoleon Dynamite-esque glory, and we lost our collective shiz in Corey Antimer? Well, one day, word circulated in the Mormon underground that this dude was actually some cookie-cutter exmo in Vegas. He's drinking white Russians. He's chomping edibles made out of ground-up copies of the CES letter. Then, just as quickly, news made the rounds that, no, actually, he was just a regular old Mormon, and he was living here in Salt Lake and getting interviewed in his car by Lindsay. And all of that happened within the space of just a few hours. Really.
Thanks, Internet.
The second, much more sad example came when word started to get out that our friend, historian Michael Quinn, had died. Because of the power of social media, that shocking news was confirmed again in just a couple hours. Remember, this information had to travel 662 miles from California to Utah, but it did, and we had accurate data. It didn't make it any easier to process, but it was at least correct.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
What are we talking about here? Rewind to 1842 and it will make sense. We started with a newspaper article about Lilburn Boggs getting shot in Missouri. Notice that it was reported on May 16th. Yeah, it actually happened on May 6th, 10 days earlier. 10 days! And it wasn't even right. They got one really critical thing wrong. See, Boggs didn't die from the attack. The best part is the Courier-Journal even included a second article the same day saying, "The assassination of ex-Governor Boggs is confirmed." Nope and nope. The back of his head was very angry, but he was 100% alive. All right, what's going on?
Mr. Lilburn W. Boggs, and I tell you that the W stands for Williams, but you already knew that. He's sitting in his living room reading his fancy newspaper. It's Friday night, May 6th, 1842. The family just finished dinner. His daughter is rocking their baby when a blast from a revolver smashes through the window and tore into him. In fairness to the Courier-Journal, it was pretty gnarly. Two balls smashed into his skull, one lodged in his neck, and yet another went into his throat. Apparently, he swallowed it. Thank you, great newspaper details. So immediately, doctors are summoned, they rush over, and they just figure he's done for. Shots to the head in the 19th century didn't usually end well. Just ask Honest Abe. It was immediately an Encyclopedia Brown caliber mystery. No one saw it happen. The sheriff found a revolver loaded with buckshot nearby. It had apparently been stolen from a shop in town. It was a dark, rainy night, naturally. Who the hell would have done this? Remember, he's not governor anymore. He hadn't been in the big velvet chair for 2 years. As the news slowly started to spread, general head scratching resulted. First, they look at some dude named Tompkins. Seems like a good name for a suspect in the 19th century. But then he's cleared. Okay, let's put our thinking caps back on. Who had a grudge against his honor? Wait, wasn't there something with him and the Mormons earlier? Something? God's gonna see you coming.
Hold on, I'm scratching off the foil off my gum wrapper, just like Encyclopedia Brown would have wanted. As loyal history podcastites, podcastians, podristocrats, whatevs, you recall all the booing and hissing around Boggs. When we as Mormons hear his name, we all say boo and hiss. Don't you remember that primary song? Even now, all you have to do is say extermination order and Mormons will lower their eyebrows and get ready to go all Danite on the bitch. It's a B word, not the F word.
It's close.
The dumpster fire that was the end of Missouri had not been forgotten by the Mormons, no. Or anyone else, turns out. When Illinois journalists got on the case, they were quick to point a finger toward Nauvoo. The Quincy Whig, which is an amazing name for a publication, the Quincy Whig noted, "There are several rumors in circulation, one of which throws the crime upon the Mormons. From the fact, we suppose, that Mr. Boggs was governor at the time and no small degree instrumental in driving them from the state." Smith prophesied a year or so ago his death by violent means. Wait up, what is this about a prophecy?
Yeah, it's going to get a little bumpy at this point. And okay, yeah, I know Boggs is saying, it already got bumpy up in my head. See, look, that's fair. I mean, we're
just please don't make another Abraham Lincoln joke, you monster.
I don't even know what to say there. No more
if he's
Lincoln.
On a Lego, you can't make an assassination joke.
I actually played Lincoln in fifth grade.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay. Well,
Abe.
Maybe you...
I can still remember having to pull the beard off and it hurt a lot. It wasn't fair, I admit it. No, I mean, we're talking where Joseph Smith is concerned. See, at this point, the trail had already gotten kind of cold. Several dudes were thrown around as possible suspects. All of them had been cleared. Then, this one dude writes to the current governor of Missouri, Thomas Reynolds, and says, "Hey, it's totally done by one of Joe's minions." Seriously, he did actually say Joe's minions. I loved it. Remember, the Quincy Whig had also pointed the finger at Mormons, but that had kind of died down. Enter John C. Bennett. Basically, anytime you're stuck in a story involving early Nauvoo, just insert John C. Bennett and your narrative will flow again. See, another ominous event was happening in May 1842. The Babes in Toyland villain, we've talked about him nearly every Nauvoo episode, had twirled his mustache one too many times and got himself excommunicated. No joke, just a couple days before word of the Boggs shooting gets to Nauvoo. I don't know what it was with the month of May and Nauvoo. Maybe the mosquitoes got extra bitey during May, but it was always hopping in May.
Mayday, heyday.
As you likely recall, Bennett then goes on a bender, causing all sorts of problems back in the beautiful city along the Mississippi. In one of his infamous letters that was printed in the Sangamo Journal, he spilled that tea, quote, "In 1841, Joe Smith predicted or prophesied in a public congregation in Nauvoo that Lilburn W. Boggs, ex-governor of Missouri, should die by violent hands within 1 year. From 1 or 2 months prior to the attempted assassination of Governor Boggs, Mr. O.P. Rockwell left Nauvoo for parts unknown to the citizens at large. I was then on terms of close intimacy with Joe Smith and asked him where Rockwell had gone. "Gone," said he, "gone to fulfill prophecy."
Fact? Fiction? Great question. It is John C. Bennett, after all. However, there were a couple undeniables. First, Porter Rockwell was actually in Independence on the day in question. Now, he wasn't yet the legitimately scary dude with the crazy eyes who would later be in Utah, where he might just shoot you for yelling, "Get a haircut, you hippie!" But you know, he is Porter Rockwell. One would say Joseph's minions.
One of Joe's minions, definitely.
I like that because I don't know if I've ever told you this. I might have said this already on the podcast before, but when I was blogging for Feminist War and Housewives, I once said Thomas Monson and his droogs, thinking it was a clever literary reference, but it was not received so well. I just thought it was very clever.
Good try, though.
His buddies. That's what I meant. That's all I meant. Okay, so remember, Mormons flat out hated Boggs. The day after they hear about it, Wilford Woodruff wrote in his diary under the heading, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord." I love a good "vengeance is mine" quote. And this one's from Woodruff. Is this more from his journal?
Yeah. This time the Lord doesn't even take a little.
Three of us find that really funny. One of them's Juanita Brooks. Here is more from Wilford Woodruff's journal. Quote, "True information has just reached us that the noted Governor Boggs of Missouri, who, by his orders, expelled 10,000 Latter-day Saints, has just been assassinated in his own house and fallen in his own blood. 3 balls were shot through his head, 2 through his brains, and 1 through his mouth, tongue, and throat. Thus, this ungodly wretch has fallen in the midst of his iniquity, and the vengeance of God has overtaken him, and at last he has met his just deserts. Though by an unknown hand, thus Boggs hath died as a fool dieth and gone to his place to receive the reward of his works," end quote.
Wilford couldn't spell to save his life, but his writing was pretty...
I love a good just desserts, especially about, you know, a governor assassination.
Boo hiss desserts. Those are the best kind. And as a funny aside to his journal, there's an asterisk right there. And at the bottom of the page, Wilford says basically, "Whoops, just kidding, my bad. He's not really dead. Slowness of information and all that, remember." He wasn't kidding about the hatred that drips off the intricately scribed page here, however.
And he did write everything very...
And so tiny.
And like, wasn't he the dude that did the, like, doodles?
Oh, my goodness.
He, like, framed
his pages,
everything.
The day where he marries Phoebe, off the charts. Cool. They're actually that's the end sheets to Laurel Ulrich's book.
Oh, okay.
They're pretty impressive.
And a tattoo of a friend of ours, right?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, if you ever get a chance to see his original diaries, do it.
Okay, okay.
A couple weeks later, the relatively new Mormon newspaper in Nauvoo, The Wasp, which is not as cool as the Quincy Whig, admittedly, published this, quote, "Boggs is undoubtedly killed according to report, but who did the noble deed remains to be found out," close quote. And sorry to keep beating you, Mr. Horse, but we're almost a month in here from the crime, and they still think that he's dead. No name was attached to this article. William Smith, the OG crazy little brother, was the editor. But you know, if it had been him writing, it would have said something like, "That asshole Little Burn Boggs is dead, and screw him forever." William never really got the hang of subtlety. So, yeah, Mormons not exactly helping their own cause here.
And let's just say, if William, we know it wasn't William Smith, because he would have punched him a little bit. A gun was not his style, it was more fists.
William Chuck him across the room. Kick him across the yard.
Maybe a saber off the wall. We don't know. Mormons figured out a little proactive gesture never hurt anyone and soon passed the first Habeas Corpus Act, which stated that no dudes in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith, cough, cough, shall be taken out of the city by any writs without the privilege of investigation before the municipal court and the benefit of a writ of habeas corpus.
If only we could talk about legal stuff in Nauvoo.
Only we knew somebody who put down their potato peeler for 1 minute. At the same time, old John C. was not done scheming. The guy that wrote the original letter to the governor telling him to look at the Mormons dipped his quill again, if you will. This time, he reported a conversation with Bennett claiming he had evidence that Porter Rockwell was the guilty party and Joseph Smith told him to do it. Just for good measure, Bennett also wrote letters himself to various newspapers talking about his theory.
So as soon as all the king's horses and all the king's men put Lilburn Boggs back together again, he was ready to start pointing some fingers himself. 2 weeks after the habeas corpus ordinance was passed in Nauvoo, Boggs signed 2 affidavits. In the first, he claimed Rockwell was the shooter, and then in the second declared, quote, he believes, and has a good reason to believe from evidence and information in his possession, that Joseph Smith, commonly called the Mormon Prophet, was accessory before the fact of the intended murder, close quote. And boom, wheels of justice start turning. Within 2 days, Missouri Governor Thomas Reynolds issues a requisition for Joseph Smith and Porter Rockwell. And now, here's the thing. Everything we already said, yeah. But does that rise to the level needed to justify an extradition? I mean, I'm no big city John Dinger, but it seems a little iffy here. This is the equivalent of Manu Ginobili flopping in the lane. You have to raise an eyebrow.
This was all very concerning to Joseph and company. He had already written to Illinois Governor Thomas Carlin, yelling about how John C. Bennett was a cholera head and was going to raise a mob to come and drag him back to Missouri. Carlin responds, hey, calm down, Pally. No monsters in your closet. Go back to bed. He did say, however, that he would comply with any extradition requests from his Missouri colleague. In fairness to Mormons, Illinois governors would demonstrate a track record of underestimating threats. Spoiler alert, Joseph Smith was killed just like he said would happen. Once again, info moved really slowly at this time. Letters going back and forth within and between two states took forever, like as long as Michael Quinn's index. But by August, the long and certainly unwashed arm of the law moseyed into town.
A good morning, little schoolgirl. Can I go home with you? Tell your mama and your daddy I'm a little school.
Illinois was going to play ball with Missouri. Arrest warrants were issued, and a sheriff, accompanied by a constable, plus a representative from Missouri just to round out the posse, came to nab Joseph Smith and Porter Rockwell. Hold up, though, gents, because boom, the Mormons pulled out a habeas corpus card. Occasionally, Joseph Smith was actually pretty visionary. The first city ordinance wasn't the end of it, though. The second the Popos get there in Nauvoo, the city council immediately meets and passes a new ordinance that broadens their power. There were now 2 levels of security. First, they could determine that arrest warrant was simply not legally issued and throw it out. And second, even if it passed the smell test, the city court could still hold a hearing on the merits of the case.
It was time to summon Judge Judy. Normally, Judge Judy was played by Joseph Smith himself, but it's a little tough to be a judge and defendant at the same time, even for Joseph Smith. Double jeopardy, ad hominem, something in Latin, or Sir Spencer is pulled in to pinch hit for Joseph and the hearing continued. The out-of-towners were required to explain why they had arrested poor Joseph and Porter. They could read the room and decided instead to go check in with the governor. You can imagine that this wasn't exactly how things usually went down. That's what you get for messing with the Lord's anointed. Everyone listening out there, every faithful Mormon, I'm going to say his name and you can boo and hiss it. Governor Boggs, go.
Mess with the Mormons, they pull the habeas corpus card. Take that. Joseph Smith knew this time they had pulled a fast one and the next time around might not be so mellow yellow. So they asked for a habeas corpus hearing from the county circuit court, which apparently never happened. Well, when in doubt, time to Thelma and Louisa and head off into the sunset. This begins the OG Mormon underground period. Over the next few months, Joseph Smith went into hiding, moving from house to house, in Nauvoo, sometimes around Nauvoo, and you are 100% right, this absolutely provided the blueprint from everyone from John Taylor to Warren Jeffs down the road. Now, just step back for a minute because you really have to appreciate the true level of bonkos going on during this period. From the time the Boggs is shot, the following all happens. Joseph Smith marries Eliza R. Snow, Delsina Johnson, and Sarah Ann Whitney, the last one backed by revelation like we talked about, because polygamy stops for no one. Not surprisingly, as a result, rumors of polygamy are flying around, leading to Orson Pratt having a very emo moment. Walking down by the river, thinking all is lost, while I assume The Cure is playing in the background. We're not sure, but we assume.
You're calling this an emo moment. Oh, he was so sad that day. He was so sad.
I mean, yeah, that's a crazy moment. I mean, we have the note he wrote. I mean, it's...
Well, that's the thing. When we talk about polyandrous relationships, everyone always assumes the dudes were okay with it. Not so. It took a little adjusting, if you will.
Yeah, I would say Orson was definitely not okay. He made it pretty clear. At the same
Charlie
time...
Charlie Brown. What's the Charlie Brown
music? Yeah, I assume, yeah. It's you know, George Michael's walking into the room while the Charlie Brown
yes,
music
there
is playing.
It is. That's the one.
Totally. And at the same time, John C. Bennett is publishing his letters in the newspapers. Joseph Smith pulls a Michael Scott and declares bankruptcy for the second time, no less. All of this happens in that period.
The feds, or more accurately, the states, weren't just going to let Joseph Smith be habeas corpus superhero. No, no. Governor Carlin says, hey man, the crime took place in Missouri. The Nauvoo Municipal Court doesn't exactly have jurisdiction there, pal. Sorry. A circuit court, maybe, but the Mormon Justice Squad won't cut it. Just to drive the point home, Missouri and Illinois offered rewards for both Joseph Smith and Porter Rockwell, but amazingly, a change was in the air.
Pain inside, don't let me sleep. I bit the hand from which I feed.
In December 1842, a new pharaoh came onto the scene. Thomas Ford took office as the shiny new governor of Illinois. We hear no booing and hissing. He came from a judicial background, and the Mormons, as usual, figured the merits of their case alone would convince any reasonable person. If they could just hear their side of it, then they would side with them. Now, this is usually where we all say, Mormons, read the room. But for once, they were actually right.
Now, does any phrase fill you with anticipation quite like meticulous legal arguments? Okay, calm down up in Idaho, Mr. Dinger. A Mormon posse set off for Springfield. While they were there, they met with Justin Butterfield, who was a non-Mormon attorney, who really actually went to bat for them. He looked at the case against Joseph Smith and immediately highlighted one fairly obvious flaw. Joseph Smith had been painted as a fugitive from justice, and the extradition attempt was framed around that. Main problem was that federal law outlined you had to commit a crime in one state and then peace out for another state to be extradited. I mean, you know, you and I didn't attend a fancy law school at night while waiting tables at Applebee's, but I think we can grasp the argument he's making here. Joseph Smith, still pretty apprehensive, decides to go to Springfield himself. Now, at any point during Illinois, if you feel like Joseph Smith is just scared of boogeyman, remember that ultimately he can always say scoreboard and that shuts you up.
When he arrives in the Simpsons' hometown, they all play the game. A warrant is issued, Joseph Smith is arrested and held in custody, and then it's court time. Joseph Smith presents affidavits to show he was in Nauvoo on the day of the shooting. The specific argument made in the hearing was that they should be looking at the question of whether proper legal procedure had been followed during the extradition attempt, not whether Joseph Smith was actually guilty of anything. The judge determined that Lilburn Boggs' affidavit wasn't enough to actually extradite Joseph Smith, and poof, Joseph Smith is released. If you're thinking that's a pretty crappy ending to this, A, you're right. B, it wasn't over. In June of 1843, Missouri dudes tried their boldest move, just basically kidnapping Joseph Smith. But once again, the magical powers of habeas corpus saved his butt. So, did they or didn't they? Was it Porter Rockwell? What does my gum wrapper say? Did Joseph Smith tell him to do it? This is sort of like the Mountain Meadows question. Did Brigham Young actually order it? We can't totally be sure. Maybe not. But those aren't the only questions, and they may not even be the most useful questions. Whether or not Rockwell got trigger happy, it is completely clear that the Mormons straight up hated Mr. Boggs, boo hiss Boggs, and they loved habeas corpus with an equal intensity.
Orrin Porter Rockwell was Joseph Smith's bodyguard and also ran a bar out of Joseph Smith's mansion house. When Port became Joseph Smith's bodyguard in 1840, he reportedly said, "Your enemies are my enemies, Joseph." William Law called Port the lackey of the Smith house, who would shave Joseph, blacken his boots, and drive his carriage. In other words, if Joseph wanted someone killed, Port would have been a natural person to turn to get it done. Hello, I'm historian Christopher Smith. As Lindsay and Brian have explained so far in this episode, Porter Rockwell is the prime suspect in the failed assassination attempt upon former Missouri governor Lilburn W. Boggs. But what evidence do we have that Port was actually guilty? There has been surprisingly little research on the subject. Most historians are just quoting an old biography by Harold Schindler and not really digging any deeper than that. So I thought, hey, let's go back to the primary sources on this and see what we can figure out. So here's what happened. There was a rainstorm on the night of May 6, 1842. Someone snuck up to Governor Boggs' window and fired buckshot in at him through the window. 17 balls came through the window, 4 hit Boggs, 2 lodged in his skull, 1 in his neck, and 1 went through the back of his neck into his mouth, and he swallowed it. His 6-year-old daughter, Minnie, who had been tending her baby sister nearby, saw her father's injuries and screamed and went running for help. Her mother came running in and tried to stanch the blood, and a son went for the sheriff and a doctor. They came back, and the doctor pronounced the injuries were fatal. And the newspapers went so far as to publish obituaries, but miraculously, Boggs actually survived these injuries. The sheriff, J.H. Reynolds, investigated the scene, and he found some footprints in the mud, and he also found a large German holster pistol in a puddle, which was still loaded with buckshot. And he believed that loading the revolver with buckshot and the amount of powder required for firing it had caused the weapon to probably kick harder than the assassin had expected, and the assassin had lost it in the darkness and the mud and rain. And with the children screaming inside the house, the assailant had fled the scene without finding the pistol. There was a crowd that gathered around as the sheriff was doing this investigation, and a storekeeper named Philip Ullinger recognized the weapon and announced that it had been stolen from his shop. He had originally thought that it had been stolen by African-American slaves. He used the N-word, but I'm not going to dignify that with a direct quotation here. But he also said that a white man, a hired man of Ward's, the one who used to work with the Stallion, had come to look at the gun just before it turned up missing. So nobody really thought the African-American slaves were Boggs' killers, so they looked into this hired man of Ward's. And further investigation led the sheriff to believe that this Mr. Brown, who had been hired by a farmer named Cyrus Ward to train and care for his racehorse, must have been Porter Rockwell. Unfortunately, Mr. Brown had left the area immediately after the murder and could not be found. It's not clear to me from the available documents just how much evidence the sheriff actually had to link Rockwell with Mr. Brown. Rockwell was eventually acquitted by a grand jury, which suggests that that evidence was fairly thin, but we have no record of that grand jury trial, and so we don't actually know whether Mr. Brown was discussed at all at the grand jury trial, or whether Cyrus Ward appeared as a witness during the hearing. What we do know is that Boggs' neighbor, who had some knowledge of the investigation, claimed that there was a chain of circumstantial evidence against Rockwell that was so strong that no rational man could doubt his guilt. And we also know that Boggs himself was convinced that Rockwell was the culprit. Boggs believed that if Smith had not explicitly ordered the shooting, he'd at least suggested it by prophesying that Boggs would die a violent death, and then saying that the prophecy needs must be fulfilled, and that Rockwell might have then taken it into his own hands to fulfill that prophecy. John Whitmer, who was a former Mormon, reported it as a known fact that Smith had hired Rockwell to kill Boggs, and he attributed the acquittal at the grand jury hearing to the prosecution's failure to present adequate testimony at a grand jury trial. So this murder weapon and the case of Mr. Brown is a really intriguing connection, but we don't actually have enough detail to know whether that implicates Rockwell or not. I do have to say, though, the identification of Mr. Brown as Rockwell is plausible. Mr. Brown had worked for Cyrus Ward as a horse trainer, and guess who loved horses and had his own ranch on which he raised horses later in life? That would be our good friend, Port. What other evidence is there to implicate Porter Rockwell in the assassination attempt? Well, let's go through the circumstantial evidence, and then I have a few more pieces of direct evidence that we'll look at. In the circumstantial evidence category, point number one is that Joseph Smith apparently prophesied Boggs' death at least once. So according to John C. Bennett, who admittedly was a scoundrel and made stuff up, so you gotta take everything Bennett said with a grain of salt, but according to Bennett, Smith had told a congregation the previous year that Boggs would die a violent death. Bennett also claimed that Smith offered a reward of $500 to any man who would secretly assassinate Governor Boggs. And then when Porter Rockwell suddenly disappeared from Nauvoo in the months preceding Boggs' death, Bennett says that Joseph told him that Rockwell had gone to fulfill prophecy. And then after the assassination attempt was made, Bennett claimed that Smith said to me, "Speaking of Governor Boggs, the destroying angel has done the work as I predicted, but Rockwell was not the man who shot, the angel did." Bennett's story about a prophecy is supported by a couple of non-Mormon postmasters who say that Joseph Smith prophesied shortly before the assassination attempt that Boggs would not die in his bed. And as one of the postmasters remarked, "If Joseph had not had some knowledge of the contemplated murder, what grounds would he have had for such remarks? It's kind of suspicious." But then again, these postmasters may have been getting their information about this prophecy from John C. Bennett, so this may not be a fully independent source from Bennett's. And I should note, Joseph Smith denied in the WASP newspaper that he had ever made such a prophecy and said this was all just calumny made up to slander him. On the other hand, while we don't have a record of this prophecy from a Mormon source, we do have Joseph saying in the official history of the church that Boggs was the worst murderer who ever went unhung and that the law of heaven was blood for blood. So it sure sounds like Joseph not only wanted Boggs dead, but also considered it a religious duty to kill him. Point number two in the circumstantial evidence category is that Porter was in fact conveniently gone from Nauvoo during the time when this assassination took place. He left Nauvoo in February and suddenly reappeared at the end of May, shortly after this attempted assassination. Most scholars think that Port was in Independence, Missouri at this time with his pregnant wife at her parents' house in Independence, Missouri, where she gave birth to a child in March of that year. I don't know that we have any actual evidence placing Rockwell in Missouri at this time, but it would be surprising if he weren't there for the birth of his child in March, so he probably was there. We do know that he stopped in Ohio to visit his married adult daughter not long before news arrived there that Boggs had been shot, and according to his son-in-law, when Port arrived, he was riding a fine horse. I doubt if he owned it. Could this have been the fine racing stallion that Mr. Brown was supposed to be training and caring for his employer, Mr. Ward? Point number three in the circumstantial evidence category is the way that everybody reacted once Porter got back to Nauvoo. So the WASP newspaper celebrated Boggs' death as a noble deed. Joseph Smith announced it from the stand. And according to Thomas Sharp, an anti-Mormon newspaper editor, "The prophet has presented said Rockwell with a carriage and a horse or horses, and he had suddenly become very flush of money and lives in style." When an extradition order arrived from Missouri and the governors of Missouri and Illinois offered rewards for Joseph Smith's and Porter Rockwell's capture, Rockwell and Joseph went into hiding and announced their intention not to give up and to resist arrest by force of arms. When Port was later arrested and extradited, he made two separate attempts to escape. Were they just afraid that any trial would be rigged against them? Or were they fleeing justice because of a guilty conscience? There's a devil in my soul. He changes faces. Rockwell was never convicted for murder, but he served a prison sentence for his escape attempt. And when he got back to Nauvoo, Joseph gave a famous prophecy. "Orrin Porter Rockwell, so long as ye shall remain loyal and true to the faith, you need fear no enemy. Cut not thy hair, and no bullet or blade can harm thee." In accordance with this prophecy, Rockwell didn't cut his hair until 1855. Was this promise of invulnerability to bullets and blades a reward for murder committed in service of the kingdom? If Joseph Smith seemed suspiciously approving of Rockwell after the assassination attempt, one other person had a suspiciously opposite reaction. Rockwell's wife, Luana, seems to have become estranged from him during this period. Harold Schindler, Rockwell's biographer, speculates that it was because his loyalty to the church was greater than his commitment to her. So that's the circumstantial evidence, but there's some direct evidence as well. In the direct evidence category, first we have William Law. This was a Mormon who defected from the church, and in an interview in the 1880s, Law told an interviewer that Joseph Smith had openly confessed to him his role in the Boggs assassination attempt. "Let me tell you that Joe Smith told me the fact himself," Law told the interviewer. The words were substantially like this: "I sent Rockwell to kill Boggs, but he missed him. It was a failure. He wounded him instead of sending him to hell." Most historians consider Law to be a very reliable witness, which I can't say for most of the other people involved in this story. So this is a big piece of evidence against Rockwell and Joseph Smith. The second piece of direct evidence comes from Joseph H. Jackson, a less credible witness than Law. Jackson infiltrated the Mormon community in 1842, apparently with the intention of bringing Joseph Smith to justice. Then he wrote an expose, a book about the experience, which is full of salacious details. Some of what Jackson says can be confirmed from other sources, and some of it seems embellished. He was a scoundrel in his own right, so you've got to take everything he says with a grain of salt. But supposedly, Joseph took him out for a ride on the prairie one day, and during the ride, Joseph told him that it was the will of God that Boggs should be killed, that Rockwell had started the job and left it unfinished, and that Joseph would pay Jackson a $3,000 reward for Boggs's blood. Now, I believe this story. If you haven't listened to episode 20 about the assassination attempt on Grandison Newell, there's testimony in that episode from Solomon Denton where he explains the religious rationalizations that Joseph Smith gave to him for murdering Newell. And those religious rationalizations sound very similar to the ones that Joseph Jackson attributes to Joseph Smith in connection with the murder of Boggs. So it's just a fairly plausible story, given the similarities between those two men who gave completely independent accounts of completely separate episodes. This also was not really consistent with Jackson's view of Joseph Smith. Jackson saw Joseph Smith as essentially an atheist, and so it really shocked him that Joseph Smith used so much religious language to justify killing Boggs. And so I don't think this is the way that Jackson would have told the story if he were making it up. The third piece of direct evidence, which comes from the non-Mormon general Patrick Edward O'Connor, who commanded a U.S. military force in Utah in 1862, is that he claimed Porter Rockwell had bragged to him about shooting Boggs. According to him, Rockwell said, "I shot through the window and thought I had killed him, but I had only wounded him. I was damned sorry that I had not killed the son of a bitch." Okay, so that's the direct evidence. But what about the denials? Because both Joseph Smith and Porter Rockwell denied any involvement in the attempted assassination. For instance, in a speech to the police, Joseph said that Rockwell was falsely accused of trying to kill Boggs. Joseph also said in an 1843 letter that, "I am ready to testify that I never instigated OPR to murder Boggs, and never had any knowledge of the case except from public reports." So those are pretty explicit denials from Joseph Smith. What's interesting is that not all the denials were this explicit. And while Joseph Smith definitely lied outright sometimes, he also liked to kind of play word games. Like with polygamy, he'd say something that sounded like a denial that he was engaged in polygamy, but it wasn't quite an actual denial. He would choose his words carefully so that in some technical sense they were true, even though they were deliberately designed to mislead people. So, for instance, in the Book of the Law of the Lord, Joseph wrote that Rockwell was an innocent and noble boy, my soul loves him. And as for his own role, after receiving reports of Boggs's death, Joseph wrote to a newspaper that he died not through my instrumentality. My hands are clean and my heart pure from the blood of all men. The thing about these denials is that in Joseph's religious worldview, it isn't a sin to kill a murderer. So since Boggs was a murderer, Porter Rockwell could kill him and still remain an innocent boy. And Joseph could be the instigator of killing Boggs and still have a pure heart and clean hands. And Rockwell may have been appealing to the same logic when he said in his own habeas corpus petition, "I am not guilty." Porter also went to John C. Bennett's house after Bennett published his exposé and threatened to whip him for saying that Joseph Smith had paid him to kill Boggs. Bennett answered that he hadn't said that Joseph had paid him, only that Rockwell had been in Missouri at the time of the murder and that he had been the likely culprit in the assassination attempt. Rockwell replied, "Well, I was there in Missouri, but if I shot Boggs, they've got to prove it." And he said, "I have never done an act in my life that I was ashamed of, and I do not fear to go anywhere that I have ever been, for I have done nothing criminal." Now notice that that's not a denial. He's saying, "I've never done anything I was ashamed of." That doesn't mean he didn't kill Boggs. It just means if he killed Boggs, he's not ashamed of it. Later in the conversation, Rockwell said a little bit more explicitly that he had been accused wrongfully of wishing to assassinate Boggs or of being ordered by Smith to do so. But even that may have been technically true, because Porter probably didn't see the killing as an assassination. And it may not even have been something he had really wanted to do. Also, Joseph probably hadn't so much ordered him to do it as hinted that he should do it, or maybe convinced him using religious justifications that it would be a good idea. Later in life, Porter Rockwell told a crowd that, "I never killed anyone who didn't need killing." That's an interesting statement. He had definitely killed people, but he only killed people who he thought needed to be killed. And at Rockwell's funeral, future church leader Joseph F. Smith said, "They say he was a murderer. If he was, he was the friend of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, and he was faithful to them and to his covenants, and he has gone to heaven and apostates can go to hell." In other words, he's saying, "I'm not saying Porter didn't murder people. I'm just saying that if he murdered people, he did it out of faithfulness to Joseph and Brigham, and he's not going to hell for it." Well, okay, Joseph F., thanks for that clarification. May Porter Rockwell rest in peace then.
You can run on for a long time.
So before we get to our Books of Mormons report for tonight, I want to remind you about the Edith Romney Project we've got going on. It's a grassroots transcription project that relies on you, who love Mormon history and want to get involved, to go and transcribe key documents that are still just in manuscript form. If you're interested in participating, go to edithromneysociety.wordpress.com and find a project that will interest you. We've got some folks on board. We've got people sharing projects. We've got people who are coming up with their own ideas, which is awesome. I really like this idea, and I really hope that the people will catch the vision. So if it interests you, get involved.
And Edith Romney is with a Y.
Thank you.
And I want everyone to look at their podcast player right now and notice the minute it's on. Brian, tell them your email address if they want to ask questions, because we've been getting a lot of questions.
Yes. Probably easiest one is just my name, Brian R. Buchanan, and that's Brian with a Y, not an I, like weirdos. So BrianRBuchanan@gmail.com.
And while we're at it, this is an invitation / commandment that you register for the Sunstone Summer Symposium. What is really fun this year is we are doing a hybrid option, which means we have a complete digital registration, so you can attend from anywhere in the world, even in the most exotic places. So hopefully you'll be enjoying Sunstone from the Caribbean or something like that. Or you can enjoy it in person with people like Brian and myself. myself. We will be there in Salt Lake City, July 28th through the 31st, 2021. In the morning, it will be all digital. In the afternoon, it will be in-person sessions. And you can meet and hang out with us, buy our swag, listen to us talk. And what are we going to be doing Saturday evening?
Ooh, we got a trivia contest, which is all sorts of fun.
If you want to play Mormon nerd trivia with us, or rather we play it at you, because we're going to host it and you're going to play and we're going to watch you win or fail. We'll have more information on our website. Christina Rossetti is organizing, so you can reach out to her directly or just wait to hear more information. We hope to see you at Sunstone. Please register, throw the podcast a donation, keep this little nonprofit chugging along.
Lindsay gave me a really useful mnemonic to remember how this symposium works. It's called the Symposium Mullet. Digital in the morning, in person in the afternoon.
I did not come up with that, unfortunately, but I wish that I did.
All right. Books of Mormon's report time. First up, we go back once again to the Joseph Smith papers. Yes, we have talked about them many times, and there is a reason for it, because it's such an amazing project. So the legal part of Joseph Smith's life is perhaps the least studied and researched part of his life. And they've done amazing work on this. So this, the assassination attempt and the extradition attempts, very well laid out there. They give you the documents, but they give these great introductions that are really concisely done, and they give you a very good picture of what was going on. So that's very important for this. And then there's a fantastic biography of Porter Rockwell called Orrin Porter Rockwell, Man of God, Son of Thunder. And it is kind of old at this point. We're going almost on 40 years since the second edition was done, but it's really good. Hal Schindler did a fantastic job. It's well-written, it's well-researched, and it doesn't hurt. He had a, let's say, mildly interesting subject to write about.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.